Welcome to the Regent Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined by my co-host, AC, who's going to take us into the episode. On this episode, we have Brita and Bryce Lundberg of Lundberg Family Farms. This father and daughter duo is representing the third and fourth generations of their family business. Lundberg Family Farms is supporting regenerative agriculture with their organic and regenerative organic rice and quinoa products that now includes 107 total SKUs. In this episode, we learn about how the Lundbergs got their start farming rice in California, how market opportunities through brands have guided their pursuit of organic and regenerative organic farming, and the big goals they have to certify all of their rice regenerative organic certified by 2027. Brita and Bryce are a super fun father-daughter duo. We had an amazing time chatting with them. You're in store for some cool learnings, great laughs, and engaging storytelling. Let's dive in. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Regen Brands Podcast. Super fired up today to have our first father-daughter duo to the podcast. So welcome, Brita and Bryce Lundberg from Lundberg Family Farms.
Thank you. It's awesome to be here with you. Thanks for including us.
We're excited to talk with you.
Yeah, we are excited to talk with you. I've worked in this natural food industry for about 10 years now. And one of the first things I had to sell was quinoa into the grain set. And I vividly remember 10 years ago trying to take space from Lundberg and talking to grocery managers who would say, you can't touch Lundberg. You know, that everything moves, everything sells, they're gold, you know, and I quickly realized the reputation that Lundberg has in the natural category. I became a consumer of the product. My favorite SKU is the Wild Blend. Absolutely love it.
Thank you.
Especially when I cook it with bone broth, it's an absolute win. But for those who are not familiar with the brand, those must be people who don't buy rice, give people a lay of the land, you know, like what do you produce? How many SKUs do you have? Where can people buy your products? Walk us through the product portfolio.
Well, I think first and foremost, we produce a lot of different types, different varieties of packaged rice. Mm. We grow 17 varieties of rice.
Wow.
And so we hope to have a rice variety that everybody loves from short grains to medium grains, long grains, arborio types, basmatis, jasmines. Then we produce some different color rice varieties, red and black, and wild rice. So we produce a lot of different variety. And then we try to produce that into all sorts of products that people would love and find delight. And what are some of your favorites in what we produce, Brita?
So we make rice cakes. We've got kind of our thick and classic rice cakes that have a nice crunch on them. But then we've also got our thin stackers, which are kind of like a lighter, crispier, square-shaped rice cake. We also cover those in chocolate, have our chocolate thin stackers. And then we've also got our fairly new rice cake minis, which are kind of more munchable.
I love those.
We've got rice chips. And then outside of the snack category, we've got some boxed side dishes like risottos that you can make in 20 minutes. They're kind of foolproof. And then some other sort of rice pilaf, rice and seasoning mixes as well. And a few ready-to-heat microwavable rice varieties and rice syrup as well. Am I missing anything?
Those are awesome. Yep.
And the SKU count is triple digits now, right?
Yep. I think total SKU count is 107. So just over 100.
Wow. Incredible.
Wow. That's wild.
I just also mentioned I eat the thin stackers on a regular basis. When I'm feeling incredibly into my fitness routine, I count my macros. And those thin stackers are the easiest way to just like, if I just need a carbohydrate in a snackable form really quick, it is the best way to just get a clean, you know, carb into my diet on a regular basis. So really appreciate that product.
Oh, well, thanks,
Kyle. I like all those, all four types of rice cakes, especially the ones with the dark chocolate.
Yeah, those are pretty good.
I'm a historical rice cake guy, just the good old fashioned thick circles with some peanut butter on them. That's my go-to product of y'all's. But I think this is a really exciting episode for us for a lot of reasons, y'all. Y'all have been around for a long time. Y'all have really shown what a, you know, organic and regenerative organic business can do with time and having some success. And it's a true kind of family run deal, as shown by y'all both kind of being here with us. So Bryce, maybe you kick us off with just some of the origin story and how we got to this point that we're at here in 2023.
Thank you. You know, I am third generation here on the farm, and Brita is fourth. Wow. My grandparents moved to California in 1937 from South Central Nebraska. They had gone through the Dust Bowl. They had gone through the Depression. And they'd seen how farming practices can really strip the land of topsoil and cause really climate change. They experienced climate change in the 30s, seeing just the that they didn't have rain and the land just was, just really degraded. And when they came to California, Grandpa said, we're going to do things differently. We're going to farm in partnership with nature, and we're going to leave the visionary. Land better than we found it. Grandpa, I think he was a visionary. They had my grandparents, Albert and Francis, they had four boys. When they came here, the youngest Homer was 2. I think the oldest, Eldon was 10. And, my dad Harlan was 4, and they came here to start over. My grandpa Albert was 50 years old, really came here with just, dream and promise and started over. And, I'm thankful that he did. Not that there's anything wrong with South Central Nebraska, but they came to an area that had good land, abundant water, and a great climate. And rice had been established here at that time. Brita, what would you add to the to that story? When did we start milling rice and producing the rice products that we have?
In the 60s, really, is when they started planting the seeds of the company that would become Lundberg Family Farms. But I think it's easy to forget that, you know, when great-grandpa Albert and Grandma Frances moved here, they really were starting over. I, as an intern in high school, I would interview my Uncle Wendell. It's my favorite things to do. I remember him telling me that, you know, when Grandpa Albert started buying land in the area, everyone told him, Albert, that land's no good. You're going to go broke on that land. And he would take his boys out there and, scoop up a shovel full of dirt and say, you know what? This is good ground. You see that weed there? That's going to add a lot of fertility to this field. And just point out different things about the field that he thought, you know, made it have potential. And he said, you know, this is good ground. It just needs a good farmer.
Did he know at that time rice was the thing, or was that kind of experimented into becoming the thing?
Well, where we are in Northern California, we're about 100 miles north of Sacramento. Rice got started here around 1910. The first settlers came here about that time, and they thought they were going to grow the crops of the Midwest, corn and wheat, and the grains from the Midwest. And the soil we have here is heavy clay, and it is not accommodate.
If we ever decided to stop farming rice, we could go into pottery. Like, it is that heavy
clay. Wow. Yeah. And then about 3 feet down is hard pan, compressed sand and clay. And it just, our fields are like bathtubs.
Yep.
They just don't allow water to percolate or penetrate. And so it's great for rice. It's not very good for very many other crops. But, you know, Grandpa knew he was coming here to farm rice.
And he was organic from the start, right? And that was rather contrarian at the time. Or what was his journey in terms of organic, regenerative, et cetera?
Well, He came with the idea that he's going to improve the soil. Most people were burning rice straw at the time. And he said, no, that rice straw, it's a building block for healthy soil. And he said, we're not going to burn straw. We're going to put that straw right back. The soil produced that straw. Okay. It's going back.
Educate me real quick. Hold on. What is rice straw and why do people burn it?
Well, rice grows in water, you know, in paddy, but the structure of the rice plant is a lot like wheat or oats. You have a main stalk, and then at the top of that stalk, you have the grains of rice. You could, might call it a rice head or a panicle. There's about 100 kernels on that rice stalk. And so when you harvest the rice, you're just bringing in the rice grains. The straw and all the stalks, they remain in the field. And they really need to be put back into the soil and returned to the soil. And when you have a living soil full of microbes and life, that straw will, over the winter, will decompose and it'll go it'll go right back into the soil, increasing organic matter, you know, increasing the tilth of the soil, improving the tilth of the soil.
So it's almost using the rice straw as a cover crop in a way, protecting the soil. Yeah, I mean,
it is in the cover, or it becomes, it could be a cover. Grandpa, though, he would plant oats and vetch. After harvest, he would plant oats and vetch to grow in the wintertime. If it was a dry winter, it would do pretty well. If it was a wet winter, it would drown. But got to put drains out in your field because the fields are not going to percolate the water. You got to surface drain it off. But we had a super wet winter this year, and some of our cover crops made it. A lot of our cover crops drowned. But Grandpa would put the straw back in. The thing why people would burn it is one match could burn off, you know, a whole field of straw, and then you wouldn't have to put that back in, right? So putting the straw back into the soil, it takes effort. It takes work. But over the long term, it's improving your soil. And so he was a visionary in that. He never stopped growing cover crops. Cover crops were core value to him and to our family. Resting the ground periodically and letting that cover crop come to full production. So most of the cover crops we grow are just a form of fertility, right? You want to mix up that diet for the soil. And it's a little bit like putting some green juice, right? When you put that green plant back into the soil, it helps the soil receive the straw and the green plant. And then when you have a legume like a vetch, the vetch takes nutrients from the air like nitrogen and puts them right back into the soil as the first form of plant food or fertility for the coming rice crop. And so those were things that he started that we continue to do.
And I can see Kyle's brain turning. I know my man's got 27 questions about the agronomic practices that y'all implement, but before we go there, and we want to go there next, bring us home on the origin story around Brita. You mentioned in the 60s, the kind of the commercialization and the branding ramped up. Just take us through that journey of like, were y'all selling to other people? Then you kind of brought that in house. Like, is this fully vertically integrated? Like that, more that commercialization brand side of the origin story. And then we'd love to talk more about the agronomy.
Sure. So in the 1960s, Albert's sons, Eldon, Wendell, Harlan, and Homer, and yes, those are their real names, started planting the seeds. The company that would become Lundberg Family Farms in 1969, a company called Chico-san came knocking, and they were looking for someone to grow organic rice for them. I think they asked something like 150 farmers in the region. They all said no until they found the Lundberg brothers. The principles of organic farming kind of seemed to align with their dad's advice to leave the land better than they found it. And I think they were most of the way there, but you know, it was early days. It was the 60s. So they didn't even really know what organic meant. I think they called up the Rodales because of Organic Gardening magazine and said, you know, we're going to figure this out from the ground up. So they planted their first crop of organic rice in 1969. It wasn't a lot. It was like 76 acres, but it was enough to convince them to make a go of it. Soon they bought an old bread truck, filled the back with bags of rice stenciled with the Lundberg name, and hired a driver to stop at health food stores along the coast from California to Washington.
My uncle, that's so cool.
Yeah, and in my Uncle Wendell's words, they also started receiving orders from long-haired hippies who filled the his words, not mine, filled the back of their VW buses with rice and then went on to start natural foods companies. One of those long-haired hippies was Michael Funk, the founder of UNFI.
He had Mountain People's Warehouse on the West Coast, and Cornucopia was on the East Coast, and those two companies, they met in the middle and then they merged. And Michael Funk was one of those visionaries. That wanted to bring natural and organic food, you know, to the to America. And I think at Mountain People's it was distributing where no one has ever gone before or something like that. But the other one that came here just regularly was Terry and Brian Fowler from the Fowler Brothers, one of the early natural food distribution companies from the Bay Area. You know, just so blessed that there was a community of consumers interested in organic food, in food that was grown a new and different way.
Yeah.
So, you know, my dad and uncles, they were part of a co-op called Rice Growers Association, a huge co-op, just growing cowrows, medium grain, and pretty much exporting it all abroad. And my dad and uncles asked that co-op, hey, we are proud of the rice we grow. Why don't you market in the U.S.? And brown rice is so much more nutritious for us than white rice. Why don't you come out with a brown rice? And pretty much the co-op leaders got tired of them and said, you know what? You want to do it. Why don't you do it yourself? And I think that was part of then saying yes to Chico-san and saying yes to we will build a little mill and start growing organic rice and milling it ourselves. Eventually, they got kicked out of the co-op. Yeah. They said, you know, you can't do that yourself and stay in the co-op. They kicked us out. And that was a tough decision as well to say, we'll completely leave. But it's been a great decision and not always that easy. But certainly as you grow, there's growing pains. But, we're really thankful that they had that vision. When I was in high school, my dad went to a food equipment show in, I don't know where it was. I think it was like Las Vegas. And he came home with a rice cake machine. He said they were popping rice cakes right on the floor with his rice cake. I think we can do it here at the farm. Yeah. And he brought a rice cake machine home. And I think his brother said, you're crazy, Harlan. But you know what? Today we have...
Yeah.
I think probably 300 of those little rice cake machines. We make them ourselves, and we produce rice cakes every day. And I'm sure thankful that you guys know about them and choose them as part of your daily or weekly food choices.
Yeah, they're great. You know, one thing that strikes me as very interesting, you know, we've done a lot of these podcasts, and when you're talking about agriculture in the 30s, you know, a part of me was originally blown away, like how did they know not to use this stuff? But it's post World War II, right? So a lot of those practices that have really depleted the soil in quote modern industrial ag hadn't really been implemented at scale the same way that they were in like 50s, 60s. So I think that's really interesting. And I'd love to try to understand how Lundberg maintained those good agricultural practices as the quote green revolution and those other like industrial farming techniques were starting to ramp up.
Well, when they first started farming organically, it's a really good question, Kyle, that, you know, I think in the 50s and 60s, conventional or chemical fertilizer and pesticides started being used in our area. And and I would say my dad and uncles, they continued to put their straw in and grow cover crops and rotate. But I think they did use, I mean, they were just selling into a co-op. Everybody's rice just went into the same bins.
Right.
But I think they saw the impact and decided to go a different direction. But when they started farming organically, like Brita said, they didn't really know what they were doing. They didn't know how to control weeds with, how do you control weeds? The only tools we knew we had were water, and we continued to manage weeds with water. Mm-hmm. But they knew that keeping the plants covered right after planting would suppress weed growth, or at least certain types of weeds. Mm-hmm. And they started doing that. But I can remember as a kid going out and looking at organic fields with my dad and thinking, man, those are awesome. and I couldn't tell the difference between what was rice and what was weed. And my dad could. Mm. He would say, well, it looks green. It looks beautiful. But most of what you're seeing are weeds. And
wow.
It took them a long time. They had probably more failures on organic rice. It just seemed, I think, in the early days, a little bit of a luck of the draw. Mm-hmm. Were you going to get a heavy weed pressure, or were you going to get rice? And I'm just thankful for their foresight. They said, we're going to figure this out. And we have systems and or processes or a farming plan to farm organic rice that that we have today, because they were insistent that they were going to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Now, do we have weeds? Absolutely, we have weeds. But we're fortunate here in California that it doesn't rain here in the summer. Mm-hmm. It's not a humid a climate. With humidity comes disease and insects, and we're our big issues are weeds. Mm-hmm. Grass weeds that look like rice. They grow like rice, they're structurally very much like rice. Mm-hmm. They drown about 48 hours before the rice will drown. That's our weed. We keep the rice underwater and the weeds underwater until the fourth leaf. And you got to go out there and you got to be out there. Yep. You can't just do it. You got to get out in the fields. The first leaf comes, second leaf, third leaf. The fourth leaf of the rice has to break through the water in order to live. Same with the grass. Mm-hmm. And for most of the 17 varieties we have, that fourth leaf of the rice will emerge through the water before the grass will. And then the grass will drown and the rice will continue to push a fifth leaf. But all the while, you've got bulrush, small flower umbrella plant, lilies,
duck salad,
all growing. Those are aquatic weeds that you're not going to drown.
And so while you're trying to drown the grass weeds, the aquatics are just loving it and thriving. As soon as you drown the grass weeds, it's time to dry up the aquatics.
Okay, comment and two follow-up questions. Comment is, one thing that I pulled out of what Bryce just said was you had somebody come with an offtake and a market to change your agronomic practices to organic, basically, because you were no longer just selling into a commodity co-op. Right. And I want to highlight that because that's the whole point of this podcast is we're trying to bring a voice to basically the brands in regenerative agriculture that are creating markets to change these agronomic practices. And we don't think that's talked about enough. So that's what I heard in there was, look, we had an offtake that could create a market for these things to change. And then we sustained them because we kept that market, right? Two follow-up questions on the agronomics are, you know, I know nothing about rice farming. So like when I think of water control here, are we talking about the area gets this much rainfall and it just floods naturally? Are we talking about it's irrigated and you have like, you know, guards that you then like let out to drain the fields? Like how does the water fluctuation like work and how is it controlled?
Well, our farm is about 10 miles from where this Feather River comes out of the Sierra Nevada. Mm-hmm. And it is a mm-hmm. robust river. There's and the Sacramento is Sacramento River is on the west side of us, about 20 miles. That mm-hmm. watershed has more water that runs through it than the Colorado. It is wow. a robust watershed.
Wow.
You can think about the Colorado. The Sacramento yeah. River is a robust watershed. And so there is an abundant water source. Our aquifer then is also largely untapped. Mm-hmm. But we rely mm-hmm. primarily on surface water. But in a drought like we had the last couple of years, we also then mm-hmm. use some groundwater. The rice is paddy rice. Mm-hmm. So we grow mm-hmm. in paddy. We have a system of levees, right? So you say you have a 100-acre field, there might be five or six different checks. And here in the, and this is probably getting too much wow. into the weeds, but for every.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
That's right.
For every 100 feet, there's 1 inch of fall, right? And so if you have a 100-foot check, then, you know, you're gonna have a fall. And you want your paddies to be pretty much flat. And that's...
So, Bryce, are you saying that the field has a yeah. slant then? So basically every 100 feet, it's kind of slanted an inch right. down. And so that's how you would drain them and, you know, after you... flood them, or I don't know what the proper
right,
term
but,
is.
But you're going to put up some levees about every 100 foot. You're going to put a levee up, and you're going to have little gates wow. on each end of that levee to let water go from one check to the next check. And you've seen pictures of terrace farming in mm-hmm. other parts yeah. of the world, or terrace rice. This is a form mm-hmm. of terrace farming, only the terraces are generally very flat. You hardly see the but mm-hmm. but there's a drop. Water will go from one paddy to the next, mm-hmm. And that's how we manage mm-hmm. the water.
I'm struck by the specificity. I mean, counting leaves on individual plants, 1 inch over 100 yeah. feet. Like when I think about growing rice, I think about mm-hmm. these massive fields, and the level of specificity that you're detailing mm-hmm. here is kind of blowing my mind to think about. It takes that level of precision to grow rice. It's just insane to me. I feel like I've taken rice for granted my whole life. so just want to comment on that. That's extraordinary. I also want to, you know, kind of back to the origin story, like, you know, the Lundberg family has been growing with these principles from the get-go, you know, like you mentioned, 1937. When did regenerative start to become part of that conversation? And how did, because it feels like a lot of the practices have always sort of been at least partially regenerative. And, you know, given the new hot button term it is in the industry and wanting to like align with that consumer group, what did that look like both from a agronomic standpoint? What new principles did you have to implement? And then from a total company like marketing perspective, how did you start to tell that story to those consumers?
Good question. Well, you know, we became aware of regenerative, the term regenerative, I think several years ago. My cousin Grant Lundberg, at the time he was our CEO, he was on the Rodale board of directors. And I think, you know, a lot of the origin of much of the regenerative movement might come from the Rodale group or Rodale Institute. And we did, I think, have a question to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Is organic good enough? Isn't organic, you know, the term that we want to support and what we've been supporting from the get-go. And so it took a while for us to say, nope, we believe that that organic is a continuum, that you have the base or the lowest form of organic that the USDA will accept or approve. You have organic forms of farming that go way beyond that are practiced by incredible farmers across the country, across the world. And I think for us, regenerative organic is about recognizing those practices, the farming techniques that have been honed for decades or for generations. Yeah. And we've embraced regenerative organic, I would say in that way, that it recognizes farming practices that are elevated above what might be considered the minimum requirements for organic. And we believe we've been practicing those regenerative organic farming techniques and putting that into practice for, well, even though Grandpa Albert didn't know he was farming organically in the 30s, many of the practices of regenerative agriculture were practiced by my grandfather. And I might just mention, you guys, that my grandpa was, I think, a visionary. He was a great farmer. He would come and tell us sometimes, you know, when one door closes, another one opens. And I would just remind you that that means to me that he was a great farmer, not such a great cabinet maker.
Well, one thing I think that we've tried to do is like, how do we distill, it's super complex, it's super nuanced. How do we distill it down into like easy digestible frameworks for the consumer? Right. Yeah. And so maybe one thing that y'all could do for us is if we're looking at an image and we have conventional, we have kind of like regular organic, then regenerative organic, what are just some of the major differences in those three buckets? Like how would you articulate maybe some of the practices or just the different like approaches in that three-pronged framework?
Right. So we do recognize that there are at least three elements that need to be considered and practiced in regenerative. It's about the soil. Mm-hmm. It's about the animals that are either brought onto the farm or are there in the wild, and the people who participate in farming and do that commitment or have that commitment to work with us. And so in the soil, I would say it is about improving the soil and having a mind, treating it like a living thing, I think is what we would like to remind, that soil isn't an inert material. My dad used to remind me that most farmers think of it just as a place to put seed and for the roots to hold, but
just as a medium, thing.
Right?
And we would say no. The soil is—it's all about the soil. You care for the soil and have a healthy soil, you'll produce a healthy plant, which will produce healthy food, which will sustain healthy people, and it's all about the soil and the things you can see in the soil. And we can gather a lot of data about the health of the soil, but there's so much about the soil. I would say that it's just so complex. There's things we still, I think, don't know about the soil and the interaction of the things you can see and not see. There's, what do they say? More life in just kind of a shovel full of soil than there are people on the earth.
Healthy soil. I've also heard another stat that we know more about the dust on the moon than we do the soil beneath our feet, which is kind of mind blowing to think about getting to the moon and getting that dust and the investment required versus what, you know, basically keeps life on our planet sustaining. But I think that trend is changing. People are getting more interested in soil, in part because of brands like you who are prioritizing it and telling that story. So we appreciate that effort.
But then when it comes to the animals, mm-hmm. we don't have, we don't tend animals. We don't own animals here on the farm. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying we will never have animals here, but one of the things my grandpa did used to say to his sons is, it's a pretty good decision to leave the animals in Nebraska. But we do have, we have herds, we have flocks of animals mm-hmm. that come through and use our fields and live on our fields.
Our farm is part of the Pacific Flyway, which is one of the most important and threatened waterfowl habitats on the continent. And so each winter we flood a portion of our fields to provide habitat for thousands, if not millions, of migratory birds, ducks, geese, swans, sandhill cranes.
Wow.
You think after harvest, the season is over, but our work isn't done, you know, because we really believe and we know that our farm is part of an elaborate ecosystem, and we're committed to supporting that system. And so we, like I said, we flood the fields to provide habitat, replicate California's once abundant wetlands, provide vital habitat and nutrition for those waterfowl. And then our cover crops also provide nesting habitat for ducks. They've lost a lot of breeding habitat. California has lost more than 90% of its historic wetlands. Rice fields with our heavy clay soil that holds water like a bathtub, really replicates that landscape, and which is, you know, sort of regenerative in and of itself to replicate the native landscape. And so we're really proud, you know, to share our fields with more than 200 species that have been documented to use California rice fields. So much so that, you know, each spring before we start our tractors to prep the fields for planting, we check to see if ducks have started nesting in our fields mm-hmm. of cover crops. If so, we partner with our friends at California Waterfowl and other like-minded organizations to sweep the fields and rescue the eggs by hand and transfer them to a local hatchery to be incubated, hatched, raised, and released. It's one of my favorite parts of the gig. Over the years, we've rescued more than 30,000 duck eggs.
Wow.
That's wild. So
it's, you know, just some people, and by some people, I mostly mean me, but call us quacktivists.
Nicely done, Brita. Quacktivists.
But really, Brita, you know, we just think of it as part of that partnership with nature that my grandma talked about. So.
And y'all just put out a really cool like marketing PR campaign around this, which I found really interesting and really cool, right? Because obviously, I think part of regen is we're doing a lot of these things not in a way to make more money, right? To drive a profit. We're doing them because they're the right thing to do, or like whatever mm-hmm. the motivation may be. But I also think we have to use them to try and drive like some profitability or like some viability into the business. So curious just to like hear about why y'all chose to focus on that. I think it was like a full page New York Times ad. Like I saw a bunch of stuff about it. It was very like playful. And I think the word ducking was used in replacement of another word that my mom says I use too much. But just like, what was the consumer angle, or like, what did the data tell you that was the right thing to maybe lead with instead of like soil health or something else from this regenerative approach that y'all take?
Yeah. So when we were thinking about kind of how to convey the value proposition of regenerative farming practices mm-hmm. for folks who may not be familiar with even the word itself, mm-hmm. you know, we thought about, you know, talking about soil health and all these other sort of concepts that are largely unfamiliar to consumers. I think there's growing interest there, but by and large, you know, that's a pretty opaque concept, I think, to consumers. And
for
so, we were trying to kind of figure out, how to distill the sort of year round 365 days a year care that is part of our regenerative organic approach, in a way that would make sense to consumers, and serve as kind of like a point of entry to have a conversation about what regenerative and regenerative organic means to us. And so, you know, consumers may not understand soil health, but everybody loves ducks, especially baby ducks.
Yeah.
And so we sort of developed this campaign called Ducking Good Rice.
Yeah, let's go.
And
I love it.
We say, you know, not all rice saves baby ducks, but ours ducking does. And we think that the foul language, if you'll forgive
foul,
the pun,
nice.
Another one.
Is just kind of a lighthearted way to start that conversation with consumers, to kind of help them understand that regenerative organic is really a holistic, like, systems approach to farming that, you know, not just sustains, but improves the environment and the world around us, which is, you know, really where we started, right? My great grandpa Albert's promise to leave the land better than he found it.
I think it's gives a measure of care. That we don't have to do that, but, you know, if it is an indicator of care, and how do you show how you care for the soil and make an engagement with that? But if you're saving. Saving ducks or protecting duck eggs, it does, I think, give a illustration or an indication of level of care. And we weren't
sure.
That's right.
That's what we were hoping to kind of.
Yeah, it leads with humor, but I think at the heart of the campaign is really, really that care. You know that we care so ducking much about about the environment, and you know, if we care this much about ducks, imagine how much we care about our rice. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, you're right. It's really about.
I think it's a brilliant strategy, and especially because, you know, I don't think there's any little kid who has a stuffed animal of soil. You know, there's no sports teams that are called soil. You know, people have a natural empathy for animals. And for some reason, as this story in this campaign is coming to mind, or you're describing this campaign, I'm thinking about, I don't know if anybody here saw it, the video of a sea turtle that had a straw in its nostril that went viral. And, you know, people watch this video of somebody pulling this straw out of the sea turtle's nostril. And it's like the amount of empathy you feel and the pain you feel for that turtle is like, I think that was one of the catalysts for the ban plastic straws movement. Right. And that had a serious impact on the industry. And I feel like what you guys are doing with ducks is not necessarily the same thing. You're not using like a video of an animal in pain, but you're utilizing the natural human ability to connect with an animal and say, this is important to us. And I think it's a really good way to communicate the values of the brand and why regenerative is important without talking about soil, because nobody at this point really cares about soil the same way they do about ducks or other animals. So I think it's a really brilliant strategy you put together.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you. Thanks for asking about that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we appreciate about the Regenerative Organic Alliance, who is you know, provides the regenerative organic certification to us, is they recognize the migrating birds as part of a rotational grazing. You know that animal element in the regenerative program, you know, it was one of the concerns we had about, you know, whether or not as we moved into regenerative organic certification, whether or not we could check all the boxes that the regenerative movement was looking for. And we're really thankful that they, in some ways, looking outside of the traditional box of do you have cows? And how many cows do you have? Or do you have goats? How many goats do you have? But there are hundreds of thousands, not millions of birds that are utilizing our fields. And and they said, yeah, we really appreciate that and know how important that is.
It's cool biodiversity story. Yeah, I mean, two things stand out to me. One, we've created a false binary narrative in agriculture that you can't do production scale agriculture and have a biodiverse environment, right? Like we've created that. That's not true. So we need more examples of people like that are proving that to be false. And two, you know, coming from like the impact investing world, where a lot of the capital that's going to need it to be raised in this space, we're going to have quantifiable metrics that we can track to say we sequestered this much carbon, we cleaned waterways, we protected biodiversity. Biodiversity is very hard to quantify, as are all the other ones. But having a hard number to say, hey, on this much acreage, we save this many ducks. Like, that is a game changing thing, I think, for a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds to understand why this work's so important and show like a real tangible impact it's having on something that people care about.
Thankful. We're thankful for that, AC. I think it's part of what reminds us that no two farms are the same. Right. No two regions are the same. Mm-hmm. And as we move into regenerative and want to, in many ways, define regenerative, that it needs to have some flexibility. Mm-hmm. That
right.
It won't look the same in every region, and rice production in California will look different. Regenerative organic will look different in California than it does in Thailand or in India. And, right. But it will have many of the same elements, but not an imprint of each other.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Right. I'm curious, you know, and one of the things I've learned in my time in CPG, there's a lot you can and can't say on a package. And I want to give you the opportunity to tell the consumer, you know, help them understand something about regenerative organic rice that they can't find on a package, from either a growing principle or how it impacts their health, you know, why it's important. Give us kind of like a behind the scenes, like, why should consumers, aside from the duck story, which is fantastic, why should they want to purchase and consume regenerative organic rice?
Well, I think it's caring for the soil and the grain from beginning to end, from the very seed that's planted to the very seed then that comes to the consumer. And everything that it touches. Some people will say, well, regenerative organic is really just for the region where it's grown, that the food isn't any better. And I think, oh, golly, that's such so short-sighted. That isn't healthy soil going to produce healthier food? And that's one of the things you can't say, right? Is, you know, really, soil that's robust and has crop rotation and natural fertility is going to produce a better food. But our country doesn't allow that. You know, you can't really say that. Right.
Have y'all done studies, Bryce? Have y'all invested in any like data or lab work? Or like, is that a worthwhile thing for y'all to do? Like, you can't say it on pack.
Well, I think it is, AC. But so far, we haven't done a lot of testing on the nutritional component. The little nutritional component we've done is there is variability. Mm-hmm. And it from the base that FDA would put out, food and drug, to but – you know, you want to get in trouble, start saying how much better it is for you.
Right.
So that is. And I think the more visibility you have as a farmer, as a brand in the marketplace, the bigger the target you have on you. Things that we know intuitively, I think as we move forward, just knowing it intuitively is not enough. Right. But dang, we know so much intuitively, right? Mm-hmm. You can see it, you can feel it, you can smell it, you can touch it. And those things often aren't measured or measurable. That's right. But the things you know, I think consumers know too.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people say, or some people say, that you can't manage what you can't measure.
Yeah,
right.
But then we think of, you know, great grandpa Albert and my grandpa Harlan and his brothers, and they were managing healthy soil and healthy fields and a healthy environment long before we could measure any of these things. And I think there's no substitute for being out there and present in your fields. And I think that's one of the huge differences in the way that we operate. You know, we're not flying on an herbicide for grass weeds and then an herbicide for the aquatics. So we're out there, you know, every morning and every evening and reading the rice. You know, we were out there last night and checking all the fields and getting out there in our hip waders and
We have one crop a year, right? The we plant in the spring, harvest in the fall, and that is the time of year we planting, and we have rice that's anywhere from 4 or 5 days old to, what was that? I think 24 days. And that 24-day rice needs to come through. Mm-hmm. We made some changes last night. Best part of my day is the morning when I irrigate and the evening when I go home. But in the middle of the day, it's here usually in the office. But Brita will come. There's times we spend it together irrigating in the evening are wonderful times.
Best part of the day.
I'm curious, Brita, maybe to get your take on this. Like, y'all are the first U.S. grown regenerative organic rice. So just kudos there and congrats. Amazing to see y'all have committed to basically the whole portfolio being ROC by 2027, which I think is amazing. Like, what consumer trends, like back out of the macro of, hey, we need to get certified. Like, how is this affecting your business? How are you thinking about product development from here, or certification from here, or marketing, or like channel development? Like, how has that maybe shifted, or how has the regenerative organic piece affected that? I'm just super curious about that.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you know, we recently introduced our first regenerative organic certified SKU, which is a white basmati rice. Mm-hmm. And we also set a goal to certify all of the organic rice that we grow as regenerative organic certified by 2027. Mm. And so really we're looking to introduce a lot more regenerative organic certified SKUs.
Yeah.
That regenerative organic certified rice in the coming years. And I think along with that, we're really looking into how we can tell that story to consumers and convey that value proposition. Because I think that in order for this to be successful, we need consumers to pull through.
Absolutely.
We weren't sure exactly how that regenerative organic certification was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
We started talking with ROA about 18 months ago saying, you know, we're not the traditional, you know, farm that has some grain and some animals and things on it. And so we started meeting with them and it's been a very productive relationship. We took one farm through certification last year, our home farm here close to where our headquarters is, and so that was a very positive, successful beginning of a relationship, and so we'll be bringing all of our family's farms into certification this year. But I think part of our story, AC and Kyle, is that as we've been farming organically here in California, we've had lots of neighboring family farms come to us and say, we want to farm organically too. But
that's
in order to
cool.
farm organically, you need to have a granary where you can keep it separate and handle organic grain as organic. And you have to have a mill that you can mill your organic. And so we have about 25 farms in our within 100 miles of our headquarters that farm organic rice for us too. Some for over 40 years that started early on in the transition to organic back in this would have been in the 70s when the first farmers came to us and said, we want to do this too.
Yeah.
So we understand that farmers have questions about what's this going to be like and will the transition to this regenerative organic certification too. We ask all of our growers that grow for us to be with CCOF and we helped in the beginning of CCOF and continue to be supportive and try to be very positive with California certified organic farmers, but we want to be that same way with ROC. And so we're showing our growers that all of our families' farms can go through ROC, mm-hmm. And that will be this year. And then following that, we'll be asking the other growers that grow with us mm-hmm. to also yeah. take that step.
I love so much the things you just mentioned there, Bryce, because I'm going to say it again and I'm going to beat this dead horse until people stop listening to me, right? It's we need to reverse engineer this solution. The brands create the markets that spur the infrastructure and the processing and the ability to change the agronomy. And right now, mm-hmm. what we're doing, I feel like, in the space is we're rushing to the farm gate. We're asking the farmers, how do we change the agronomy? How do you adopt these practices, blah, blah, blah. And the farmers are saying, well, give me the processing support to actually keep it integrity preserved. I forget the perfect word, the term for that. And then give me a market to sell it into and make money, right? And like, we need to think about it the first way. And so I love that you've mentioned a couple of things that really validate that. And maybe it's just confirmation bias because that's what I want to believe. But like, I really do believe that that is the case, that we need to focus, you know, that order of operations.
I think Anthony's spot on there. And what I like, you, not only are you leading the way by example, but you're also providing that market, right? Which is super mm-hmm. important. But I want to get a sense of scale here. You mentioned right now you've got the one farm that's ROC. From an acreage perspective, if you don't mind sharing, like, what does that look like? And then, and you can ballpark these figures if you'd like. When all 25 family farms are certified, like, what does that look like? Now I'm thinking about the impact for those ducklings. And if we expand that to like, to what max, I want to like visualize how much land this actually is.
Well, you know, we believe it is one of the best ways to cultivate a healthier world is by farming organic mm-hmm. and even more so, mm-hmm. you know, regenerative organic, that is mm-hmm. a game changer for the world, for the climate, for our environment. And mm-hmm. every acre you can transition to organic and to regenerative organic, to me, is a game changer. And so our first farm that we brought through was around 1,500 acres. Mm-hmm. And that was the ground close in here to our headquarters. This year, our plan is for that to bump up to 8,000 acres. So we'll be able to support several more SKUs of mm-hmm. of packaged rice and rice cakes and some of the entrees mm-hmm. Or boxed items with that. And then the next step with all 25, it'll be in the range of close to 20,000 acres that will
wow.
And you know,
that's amazing.
This year is going to be 8,000, but you know, that's in growing rice. For every, you know, acre that's growing rice, there's still an additional acres that's in a rotation in something else mm-hmm. that will be coming into the regenerative organic process at the same time, because that ground is going to be in next year. Right. So if there's mm-hmm. 8,000, there's likely closer to 10 or 11 that are coming in, but only 8 are growing rice. And when we're growing 15 or 16,000 acres of regenerative organic, there'll be still another 5,000-6,000 acres that are rotating out and resting and other things. But
wow.
Yeah, it's really cool to kind of visualize like the growing land, like if you're like looking down at the world from a satellite, you know, just the growing mm-hmm. positive impact taking place on those farms in Northern California. It's really cool to envision that. So I appreciate you sharing that. You know, we sort of talked about the future a little bit in terms of how regenerative organic is going to change the future for Lundberg. Just want to touch on real quick, like even stepping back from regen, like as a brand, what is it that Lundberg is trying to achieve in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years? Are there new category penetrations you're looking to get into? Are there other ways that you can utilize rice? Is there any potential for Lundberg to make something other than rice, you know, with these cover crops and these mm-hmm. different rotations that you have going? If you can talk about any of that, we'd love to know.
Well, you know, Kyle, a few years ago, we had experienced this kind of pressure that quinoa was coming into our there were people trying to take packages of rice off the shelf.
Yeah, Kyle was out there hustling shelf space.
That wasn't me.
And so we were asked by some of our closest retailers, when are you guys going to grow quinoa? And he said, well, we could import some quinoa from South America. And they said, no, we want you guys to grow domestic quinoa.
Wow.
And so we have been on a, about a 10-year trek in figuring out how to grow quinoa here in Northern California.
Wow.
And so you can find, hopefully you can find a Lundberg package with quinoa in it at a store near you. But it's all grown in near the coast. It is too hot to grow that quinoa here in the valley where we grow rice. The the plant flowers are too sensitive. They'll sterilize at around 90 degrees. And so we grow them over close to the coast. In the, some of it in the shadow of the redwoods, some actually where the spray of the Pacific Ocean. One of the first fields we started growing quinoa in is on the Eel River, right where it comes out in the Pacific Ocean in Humboldt County. So all of it's grown in Humboldt County, and we'll grow anywhere from 250 to 500 acres of organic quinoa there. So that has been an area we branched out into, but it is quite a bit more expensive than imported quinoa right now. So we're struggling a bit in that area. But we have our eyes on innovation and some new puffed products, or new some call them snacks, but rice cake type products. Some we think that the ready to heat area is an area we need to be more active in.
And, for sure,
So that
it's all those lazy millennials and Gen Zs like Kyle and I, Bryce, that you got to start making all those products for.
What's that?
I'll say it for you. So I said it's all those lazy millennials and Gen Zs that you got to make the ready to eat products for, like Kyle and I.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not going to say anything about that, other than I think everybody wants to be able to support the kind of agriculture they're wanting to support and with food they enjoy and find delight in that fits their lifestyle, right? When you want to have that rice, and you, I think everybody has time to cook rice, but when you don't, having that ready to heat is that is one of the lines we are pursuing regenerative organic certification on. So it's, we don't have that plant that can do that magic, but we're working on, because we think that is an area of growth that we want to participate in.
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea, kind of getting out of the center store and getting towards the perimeter. It's a great place to tell a story. It's a great place to get attention and to be able to bring that regenerative organic story into those areas, I think is a really, really cool, smart idea and could be really impactful. So, like Anthony mentioned, us lazy millennials are excited about having the opportunity to support the right agriculture in those categories.
Yeah, for sure. So, y'all, this has been super fun. I'm going to take us home with the final question and would love both of y'all's thoughts on this. We asked everyone this, so I'm super, super curious what y'all are going to say. How do we get 50% market share for regenerative brands by 2050?
Well, that's a great goal.
It's a loaded question. I know.
It is. But, it takes everyone, right? It takes everyone being consumer demand is key, right? And farmers are responsive to the customer and to the buyers coming to the farm. Yeah. And I think a lot of it's that, but then also I think I'm really thankful that Governor Newsom and his administration here in California have a goal to increase organic agriculture by 2030 to 30%. And what was that? 50% by when, AC?
2050.
Yeah. So I think we got to set goals. We got to have our leaders setting goals and then having tools, right? And getting the customers to say yeah to that. But You know, there's a story I like to tell, AC, about this guy who was walking on a country road, and he came up onto a flock of sheep, and he came, went to the woman taking care of the sheep and said, "I'll bet you $100 against one of your sheep I can tell you how many sheep are in your flock." And she said, "You're wrong." And he said, "Well, you have 789 sheep in your flock." And she said, "Dang, you're right. Go ahead and take any sheep you want." And he went over and picked up an animal and started walking away. And she said, "Hey, double or nothing, I can tell you exactly what you do for a living." And he said, "Okay." And she said, "You're a economist with a government think tank." And he said, "Yeah, you're right. How do you know?" And she said, "Put down my dog and I'll tell you." And you know, the idea is that both those people have incredible skills. Everybody has different skills. We need everybody working together. Neither one of those people were right or wrong. They're both right. And we need everybody with skills in relationship to food and marketing and, you know, climate change and distribution, everyone engaged to get there to 2050. If it all depended on just farmers, we wouldn't get there. And if it was just consumers, we probably wouldn't get there. It takes everybody.
Agreed.
With different skills.
The funniest answer we've heard out of everybody we've asked, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But I think you're right.
Anything you would add?
Sorry.
I mean, how do you add to that, right? I guess I'll just say that, I don't know if you knew when you booked a father-daughter duo that you'd be having the dad jokes, huh?
Yeah, we expected a little bit of that, you know, but that's always, we like that. We enjoy that.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think that combination of, you know, we need for every step of the supply chain, starting with the producer to the consumer and everything in between, we need all of those individuals who care about this and to really push it forward. Because if we don't get those vested parties from the distributors, from the brokers, from the retail buyers, from, you know, the producers to the farming infrastructure, to the grain silos, like everybody has to be involved if this thing's really going to scale. So I think your answer is spot on. Just really appreciate the conversation we've had today and you all sharing some of these hilarious stories and jokes with us. It's been a blast to spend some time with you too.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kyle. Thank you, AC. Thank you for caring. And I would love to hear your origin story about how you guys said, "We're going to do this and we're going to promote this." And you're right in there with us, you know, you're right in there at part of making the change.
Yeah.
I love that. Thank you.
Yeah. We appreciate that. The super concise version of the origin story is both Kyle and I have had, you know, we both worked in food for a long time and have, you know, personal and family histories in food. And we also have had some large healthcare challenges that have really led us to Regen. And so I think we were personally motivated by human health, right? And then we found regenerative and it exposed us to all these other amazing co-benefits that it brings. And so we also felt like this narrative around brands creating markets that could shape the incentives for the agronomy was not being told. And so Kyle was living in Bend. I was back for my second or third stint there. And I was just a crazy guy that asked him to start a podcast with me. And he was nice enough to oblige. And it's been a fun ride ever since.
Well, awesome. And
not really much I can add to that. It's been a blast. And the best part is, like, you know, I think that Anthony and I were both having these conversations with brands on a regular basis anyways.
Yeah.
It just understanding who they were, how we could help, how we could support. And now we just get to do it in this public forum. And really we get to be the megaphone and help the brands tell these stories and share the impact that they're providing. So that's been the most fun part for me, is just being able to help that storytelling aspect for all the brands doing the great work. So it's been super fun, super fulfilling. And I'm very grateful that Anthony had this wild idea to start a podcast.
Well, that's really cool.
It's been super fun, y'all. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll do it again sometime.
Thank you. It's been really fun. Thank you for telling the stories and letting us tell ours.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Thanks, y'all.
For show notes, episode transcripts, and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also find our Regen Recaps on the website. Regen Recaps take less than 5 minutes to read and cover all the key points of the full hour-long conversations. You can check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, subscribe to future episodes, and share the show with your friends. Thanks for tuning in to the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode, and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.